The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, when you take a good long look at the future in the eyes of science, of industry, and technology, you really are left wondering whether you want to stick around until then. On the one hand, government leaders are telling us there may not be a world here in the world tomorrow, that there simply won't be any world tomorrow. On the other hand, science, technology, and industry seem to promise us a fantastic, glittering Disneyland of luxury and pleasure, and a fantastic assortment of gadgets and mechanical toys with which to play. And they portray a world where only tiny percentages of the so-called have nations of affluence and wealth can play with their ever more glittering and dazzling assortment of toys, while the rest of the world continues to get worse and worse. It's amazing when you see the predictions for the future, and when also you see the admissions of how little people know about the future. Now, for instance, just to show you here from an article in the Atlantic Monthly not so long ago, it talked about the future and how the quest for peace is the single most important problem and the greatest quest of mankind today. It was written by a well-known author and newspaper columnist, Walter Lippmann. He said the age we're living in is radically new in human experience. During the past 15 years or so, there has occurred a profound revolution in human affairs, and we are the first generation that has lived under these new conditions. The radical development is, of course, the production of nuclear weapons. While nuclear weapons have made war the old arbiter of human affairs an impossible action for a rational statesman to contemplate, we do not have any other reliable way of dealing with issues that used to be resolved by war, he wrote. And then, putting his finger on the whole problem, he said, "It is enormously difficult to make peace. It's intolerably dangerous and useless to make war about the fundamental issues. That is where our contemporary frustration and confusion originate. We're confronted," he said, "with an extraordinarily tantalizing and nerve-wracking dilemma. For as long a time as we can see into the future, we shall be living between war and peace. A war that cannot be fought, and a peace that cannot be achieved." Can you begin to believe the import of words such as these? Predictions of those who try to walk right on out into the future to tell you where you're going to be, what your life is going to be like, the stuff of which your everyday existence will be made in the future. Living in a sort of an in-between vacuum between a war that constantly hangs over our head and a peace that is absolutely impossible to achieve. That's not a very happy prediction. You can't call that good news, can you? He went on to say the great issues which divide the world cannot be decided by a war that could be won, and they cannot be settled by a treaty that can be negotiated. There are, he said, no clear guidelines of action because there are no precedents for the situation in which we find ourselves. And as statesmen grope their way from one improvisation and accommodation to another, there are masses of people who are frightened, irritated, impatient, frustrated, and in search of quick and easy solutions. You know, that reminds you of a section written by a prognosticator centuries and centuries before Walter Lippmann. Years and years ago, a man whose name was Isaiah wrote about how statesmen grope their way from one improvisation and accommodation to another. Except he said, "We grope for the wall like the blind. We stumble at noonday as in the night." That's in Isaiah 59 and verse 10. And in the section where that ancient seer says, "The way of peace they know not." Now, whether you think he referred to his time then or our time today, he was still 100% correct, wasn't he? "The way of peace they know not." That's what Isaiah said. And as if with one voice, everyone is admitting to us today, that's right, we don't know the way to peace. Now, one well-known and well-respected news commentator and columnist, Eric Severide, wrote, "It seems clear that this age of science has to be, in the history-writing sense, man's final epoch. We're now taking apart and putting to use the basic stuff of nature," and he said, "that's the end of the line. This age of science has no natural limits we know of, and what is dawning on us now is that it's also uncontrollable. science, he said, simply does not know what it is doing or where it is going. Science can't control what it will produce because that's the nature of science, and since there is no control over frightened governments and very little over eager industry, there is no real control over the uses to which the products are put. It is an ingrained human and particularly American illusion that we will always win in the ninth inning, because we always have. We're still here, aren't we? He said in this article. What shocking and what fantastic words these are. That this, in the history-writing sense, may well be man's final epoch. That science simply does not know what it is doing or where it is going. Now, I don't want to shock you too much or too much further before I do tell you some of the good news that this program is all about, but here's a fantastic statement for you. A think factory that admits before it begins to get ready to start to think that what it aspires to is common sense, but that's not what it begins with. A think factory that has been established for the express purpose of putting together some of the intelligentsia of modern thinkers. Leaders in government, business, industry, from universities, and so on. It's called the Hudson Institute. It's about 35 miles north of New York City. It's called a think factory to prevent war. And within the buildings of that institute are gathered what has been called the best reservoirs of brains in the country. The world of these military analysts is unsettling, where, as this article said on it in the New York Times, the unthinkable is thought about. But now on one of the courses when leaders in government, universities, industries, business, who need to know about the concepts for the future, gathered together to hear one of the leaders in the institute advising and counseling. That leader said experience won't serve as a guide anymore to practical affairs. The world has become too complicated. Experience says that none of the worlds we can predict for the year 2000 will work. Yet we know that one of them will have to work if there is going to be a world. Now, I want to just pause for a moment to let you get that and to say it again. He said, now let's put it in context so you understand again what we're talking about. Here is, in a sense, one of the great efforts to sort of pick the brains of the nation, so to speak, to put together a collection of the greatest thinkers possible to come up with a solution as to how to achieve peace, how to avoid war. Now, in a very serious session where leaders in many fields were there to hear what these thinkers are accomplishing, they were told, and I quote, experience says that none of the worlds we can predict, said the thinkers, for the year 2000 will work. Yet we know that one of them will have to work if there is going to be a world. It's only common sense, he said. So, in a way, he admitted, common sense is what we aspire to. Not what we start off with. Isn't it amazing? You know, your guess is as good as somebody else's about the dangerous times in which we live and about where we're headed, about the outcome of mankind. Now, as good as somebody else's, but not as good as one great overall master plan mapping out the course of human affairs and showing you there is a world that is predicted for 2000 and before, which will work, and which is going to be absolutely a peaceful world where wars will no longer be fought, and where this world will be made productive and peaceful and happy at last, and where frustration and confusion will be a thing of the past, where divorce will be solved, and crime will be solved, and the population explosion will be solved, where governments will not be warring and fighting against each other, where one world religion will finally be achieved. The right religion, the only true religion, incidentally, where one world language will finally be achieved and people educated to think in it and write it and preach in it and talk in it and write in it and read in it, and where instead of having hundreds of dialects in even any one given country such as India and China and the like, you will have just one pure language that will get right straight to the core of what you're thinking about. A world of absolute peace. Now, you know, that world has already been portrayed and depicted way in advance, but most people haven't known where. But the more you look at this world and what people are predicting, the more disillusioned and frustrated you become, the more confusing it seems. Here it is, the greatest epitome of brains and think factories and people who try to walk into the future to analyze the conditions and the trends today and to tell you, the layman, where they are taking us. and almost as if with one voice they say, well, it won't work, but it's got to work. They say there's no hope, but we hope. They say it's impossible, but it's got to be possible. They say there must be a way to find peace, but there isn't any way to find peace. It's no wonder people are jumping off bridges. It's no wonder suicide is in the fore today, and that more and more people are taking their own lives because they can't face life the way it is today. Now, in the words of a man who was quoted in Look magazine a few years back, Professor Samuel Elliott Morrison, who was a historian, he concluded, concerning this frustrating time in which we live, in asking the question, where are we and where are we going? He said, we have got to get used to living without solutions. We have to get used to living in crisis after crisis, hoping for the best, but expecting the worst. You see what I mean, my friends, wherever you live around the world, regardless as to where you go, whether to think factories, to military leaders, to the leaders in government. For instance, Mr. Johnson said, before a group of wounded Vietnam War veterans, he said, I wish I could tell you that peace in the world is just around the corner, but he said, we are in a time of trial, a time of testing, a time of uncertainty. The former President John F. Kennedy once said, mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind. Today, every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may no longer be habitable. Together, we shall save our planet, or together we shall perish in its flames. Now, Dr. Glenn T. Seaborg, who is chairman of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, said, the best condition of the world we can hope for is a continuing crisis. Dr. Harrison Brown, professor of geochemistry at the California Institute of Technology, the place where is, you know, JPL and the pictures of the lunar surface and lunar orbiter and all of the A and the H bomb research has been accomplished a great deal in this modern world. He said the most we can expect by continued vigorous participation in the arms race is a postponement of the fateful day. And Look magazine, in an article entitled The Next 25 Years, said, some facts about the next 25 years are certain. There will be risk and burdens and hardship for the challenges of the 60s, the constant threats to freedom, the opportunities for chaos and crisis show no sign of lessening even then. The revolution sweeping the world today, political, economic, social, scientific, and a host of others, will not have abated by then. Yes, I should say that the future is unsettling. I should say it's frightening, perplexing, and confusing. And it's no longer people find themselves in an absolute intangible vacuum, a sort of a dilemma of not knowing where to start and why they should start and where to go if they got started. People simply do not know where to look for the answers about the future of this world. But there is a great solution. There is some good news. There is an answer. There is a master plan that has been mapped out to achieve world peace. You probably haven't realized that centuries ago, a great prophet came to this earth who was, I can't imagine how many people have misunderstood his message, but it's amazing, who has been almost totally misunderstood, who talked about a world government. And almost, again, I use this term because it's amazing at the unanimity in thought. I say almost as if with one voice, it seems many times, but it's a fact. Almost as if with one voice, world leaders today tell us that a world government is the only solution. In the last program, I quoted Lou Thant, former President Eisenhower, the late Sir Winston Churchill. I quoted Dr. Osgood of the University of Illinois, Dr. Harold C. Urey, Nobel Prize winner and chemistry professor at the University of California. I quoted Dr. Edward Teller. They said, world authority, world government. They talked about peace with justice. A world government is the only permanent solution. As Sir Winston Churchill said, unless some effective world super government can be brought quickly into action, the proposals for peace and human progress are dark and doubtful. There it is. That's why I say almost as if with one voice all these government leaders say world government is the only hope. Now it's going to come as a real surprise to you to find that one-third of a consistent bestseller that you may have right in your own home is prophecy. And that prophecy portrays a master plan for bringing about world peace. that your Bible is one-third prophecy. You probably haven't realized that. You may not have realized that the New Testament, especially the Gospels, is a great deal prophecy, and that Christ's message was not for his day, but for ours. Now, people's curiosity seems to be aroused by someone who might predict what a governor of a state is going to do, or about some minor, comparatively insignificant event in the course of some governmental bureau or agency today. Or they will look into such predictors of the past as Nostradamus and others. But few seem to realize that most of the message of Jesus Christ of Nazareth was prophecy, and that his message was not for his day, but for ours, and that he repeatedly stated such. You can look in vain, as I was doing just before I came on the air, in some of the Bible handbooks and helps and study books, for example, in some of the sections in Christ's message where he talked about his government and how it was not for his time but for the future. And you know that it isn't even mentioned, that it's absolutely obliterated from the record, that it's totally ignored. You know that many people have falsely assumed. Now, let me tell you what you may even have thought. I'm not reading your mind, but this is probably what you have thought. Many people have assumed that Jesus was an altruistic, a wonderful thinker, a philosopher, that he was filled with goodness and love, that he was concerned about mankind, but that primarily he was concerned with beginning a movement, with changing the human spirit and nature, with trying to get people saved, as we might put in quotes, or to get them to accept or to receive him, meaning to accept his philosophy of life. But most of those same people who think of the story of the little baby in a manger and of the quiet teacher who said, love your enemies, also firmly believe in today's dog-eat-dog competitive world that all of those teachings are pretty impractical. Oh, they're willing to smile a little and go to church a couple of times a year, maybe. When it comes right down, though, to trying to come to grips with what he said and to put it into practice in their business, they just don't. They just do not. They feel that the New Testament is a book about, well, sanctimoniousness, of religiosity, of difficult-to-understand phrases, of a highly technical sort of a spiritual nature, where this man in the long frock and the white collar gets his text for today is rather a mystery to most people. You know, it just doesn't seem to relate, most people feel, to this modern 20th century of frustration and enormously difficult problems outside. The jangle and the clamor of the traffic outside doesn't seem to relate to what goes on in the interior. And that is exactly the view that many people have of the Bible. But realize it or not, admit it or not, about one-third of the Bible is prophecy, and a great deal of the New Testament is prophecy. And Jesus Christ of Nazareth came talking about a world government. He said, my kingdom is not of this world. Now, people think the New Testament is difficult to understand, but that's amazing. It's only those who haven't read it to think that is true. What's difficult about Christ telling his disciples to watch world news and conditions and changes, to keep abreast of times and trends? What's mysterious about the statement that he came for the very purpose of being a king, but that his kingdom was not for that day, but for long ahead in the future? What's difficult about simply believing the message of Christ, the message of advanced good news of a future world of peace? You probably didn't know the Bible relates to dating practices of teenagers, that it talks about how to plant a garden, that the Bible tells wives how to shop and purchase property, that the Bible talks about husband-wife relationships, that it talks about child-rearing, that it talks about business ethics and methods. It talks about landmarks and inheritance and legal documents. That the Bible talks about daily ways of living and of conducting your life. That in the Bible you can find rules for health, rules for success. That you can find the great mapped out master plan for the creation of a better world tomorrow. People have misunderstood a great deal about the Bible and the New Testament. For instance, even the proverbial statement, peace on earth, goodwill toward men, that you hear about December 25th. Each year, is the result of a flagrant mistranslation. It should have been preserved and been handed down through these centuries as peace on earth among men in whom he, God, is well pleased. Or perhaps, as another version has it, peace on earth among men of goodwill. But since men are not men of goodwill, we don't have much peace on Earth. So I've been announcing a booklet that gives you that master plan for the creation of a world tomorrow that is going to be enjoyable and livable instead of all of these statements that we've got to find peace, but we won't. That the best we can hope for is a postponement. That we've got to get used to living without solutions in crisis after crisis. You don't want to hear that kind of prediction for the future, and yet that's all you're going to hear if you listen to scientists and educators and historians and military and political leaders. I've got the quotes by the dozens from our own news bureau and Ambassador College campus with our own wire services and all the rest of it. Bulging files filled with statements of that nature. That's not very good news. But I do have some good news for you in this booklet. Full color. You can read it in one sitting, and yet it's jam-packed with facts and plenty of statements from these leaders and a whole look at the world the way it is today. It's entitled The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, What the World Tomorrow Will Be Like, What Kind of a World Can You Expect for Your Children and Grandchildren? Will the world even be here tomorrow? And if so, what kind of a world is it going to be? How will this world that is divided against itself finally find itself reconciled and find a time of absolute peace? How will the population explosion be settled and solved? It's explained in this booklet. How will vast arid desert lands? You know that only 7.7% of the earth is arable or cultivatable, don't you? It is. Only about 15% inhabitable. These vast areas are going to be reclaimed. So says your Bible. The booklet shows you where. Gives you the quotations. Now, the booklet takes a look at modern science and industry and at all of the great overall influential areas of life that make the world what it is. For example, it takes a look at education, and it shows how education in the modern world is decadent. It's a realistic look, because when you look at modern education, and you must realize, after all, that it is the educated people of this world which make the world what it is. Let's realize that the leaders of the world are those who make the world what it is. That the alma mater of each one of them has spawned the scientists, the captains of industry, the leaders in business, the politicians and rulers and leaders in this modern social order, and, incidentally, the theologians. And so you have to say, when you analyze it, that today's sick and chaotic world is exactly what its leaders have made it. And the leaders are the product of modern education. Now, you can have access to the Encyclopedia Britannica, and it will tell you that if you ever thought to even look up the term education, what is education? It will tell you that it's the system by which adult leaders of any society inject their philosophies, their customs, their ideas and culture into the minds of the younger, the growing generation. You may not realize, but you can prove it under articles on education, that education is essentially pagan in origin and character. You may not know that the present-day academic system actually was founded by a pagan philosopher, Plato. Now, that might not shock many people because they think Plato was a great thinker, the fact that all of his theories were totally impractical, the fact that he was a complete pagan with a darkened mind. This seemingly doesn't occur to many people, but in the 19th and 20th centuries, the absorption of German rationalism into the educational bloodstream occurred. Today, you see this drift into materialism and collectivism. The idea that there might be any truth to the Bible is being totally ignored, and you might get laughed out of a classroom if you suppose it. Now, on the other hand, you can come up with any kind of a theory about the origin of life you would like. For example, of recent date, there has been the most widely accepted theory for the origin of life. You know, some of this thinking dates even back to Plato and Epictetus and Aristotle and others, but they didn't put it in these terms. They wanted to find some way to establish the existence of the creation and created beings and things and life upon the earth, but without having to believe in a great divine God, a ruler. So they talked about the origin of life too. But until recently, the greatest idea was that maybe we all came from a thin soup in the primordial seas, a fetid sort of a slop, you know, that gradually these amino acids that came first produced the first life. That was the widely accepted theory. Many people still believe in it. But recently in St. Louis, a group of scientists came up with a new idea. They said, no,
Instead of amino acids coming before proteins, instead of it being a thin soup, the proteins came before the amino acids, and it was a brown scum. Still others think it was a slippery green slime.
So all I want to say is that if you want to be truly educated, according to this world's standards, you need to flip a coin. And you say, scum or slime? And you flip it, and then you say, did we climb from slime or did we come from scum? And you accept whichever of the two may appeal to you. But so far as accumulating absolute facts on the subject, well, that's something else again, isn't it? It's still filled with perhapses and maybes and supposes and possibles and all types of artificially created and simulated environmental conditions in laboratories with the chemicals there present. All you do is shake and add a little water, they say, and heat it up, they say, and you come up with scum. Well, I can do that in my own kitchen. But that doesn't prove where life came from. If you want to look into it and at least give it a chance from another point of view, then write for the book that's on Does God Exist? At least ask the question. Don't assume that God doesn't exist and assume that we have come from scum. Assume that you don't know, honestly, and keep an open mind and then look into both. Go ahead and study thoroughly into the question of amino acids and DNA and scum and slime and soup and all the rest of it, but also study to find out if you can explain law without a lawgiver, design without a designer, energy without an originator and a sustainer, creation without a creator, life without a life giver. See if you can explain the fulfilled prophecies that have been given in such intricate detail that people have been even named hundreds of years before their birth. See if you can explain the fact that those prophecies are continually being fulfilled in many areas of this earth where ancient cities were destroyed, in which the prophecies of the Bible defied mankind to ever build upon those areas again. Give it a chance. Write for the booklet, Does God Exist? And the Proof of the Bible. Now this booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What Will It Be Like? Also inside of it is a tabloid-sized newspaper, a could-be newspaper. It has an article here, for example, Total Disarmament Achieved, the kind of news we could have been reading by now if we lived differently, and our forebears. The kind of news you will be reading in the world tomorrow, believe it or not, as good as that may sound and as almost impossible as it may sound, because we're so conditioned to the bad news. But this tabloid-sized newspaper with the articles about the way the world tomorrow will really be, we've gotten all kinds of letters. People said it brought absolute tears of joy to their eyes because it was just like living a little bit into the future for a moment, and they really enjoyed reading the booklet that's full color that comes along with it to show you, taking a good look at all the facets of this present-day world, what's wrong with it, but then the good news of how it's all going to be changed and altered. A time of vast discovery, exploration in different areas. Read it with your own eyes. It's free of charge. There is no price for it. No one's going to call on you. All you need to do is write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to list the call letters of your station. Write for that booklet. It's by the title of this radio program. In case you forget, just mention the one on The World Tomorrow. And the booklet, Does God Exist? And the Proof of the Bible. They're free of charge, no price. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.